Welcome to Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary. Hello and welcome to Working the Lectionary, a podcast in which the world of work is examined through readings from the weekly lectionary. My name is Brendan Byrne, and I'm one of the hosts of Working the Lectionary, and at this point I'd normally be introducing you to my co-host John Bottomley. However, this is a special edition, because John and I have been invited by our colleague, Reverend Associate Professor Robin Whittaker of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, to join her on the By the Well podcast to discuss readings for Pentecost 10, using our particular lens of work and economy. So sit back and relax as Robin, John, and I discuss readings from Genesis and the Gospel according to Matthew for Pentecost 10.
You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Robin Whittaker, and you are listening to a special crossover episode between us here at By the Well and two wonderful folks from
Working the Lectionary.
And they are Brendan Byrne and John Bottomley. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about Working the Lectionary and who you are for listeners that don't know you?
Sure. My name's Brendan Byrne. I'm a Uniting Church minister currently in congregational placement. And with John, I'm co-host of the podcast Working the Lectionary.
Great.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to being by the well this afternoon. I work with Brendan on this Working the Lectionary at Brendan's invitation, which has been a gift to me in my sort of leisurely retirement. But I do fill in some time as chairperson of the Religion and Social Policy Network at the University of Divinity. Part of a small house church congregation that is in the Port Phillip East Presbytery, and occasional daily exercise at the local football park.
Very good. Mm. Well, it's great to have you doing this, and I was excited to invite you in for this episode because I love the focus you have on your lectionary podcast on work and economy, and I'm hoping that will help us perhaps think a little differently about our readings today, which we should introduce. It's Pentecost week 10, and we're going to focus particularly on Genesis chapter 32, verses 22 to 31, and the gospel reading Matthew 14, 13 to 21, and we might give a nod to Romans 9, 1 to 5 and the psalm along the way, but we're going to start with Genesis.
Yep.
So what do we want to say about this kind of well-known but bizarre story?
Well, I go back to my days as a theology student to begin with, and I recall Howard Wallace's lecturing on this subject, and it was a great privilege to have Howard as one of my Old Testament lecturers. And Howard explained how this reading is part of that tradition within the Hebrew scriptures, which speaks about the darkness of God, the otherness of God, which means that when humanity encounters God's qualitative otherness from our own perspective, we sometimes come to problematic outcomes as a result of encountering this otherness. And this is part of those notions of awe and fear that we find in the Hebrew scriptures that are not about us living in terror of God, but being reverent of and attentive to this otherness of God. And I think we encounter that in this reading in the sense of the stranger.
Yeah, the stranger man. And it's a disruptive reading because we're we're kind of, it shifts in a few points, right? He starts wrestling with a man, and then the man we find out at the end is God. There's some twists and turns.
Well, do we?
Well, yes. Okay. I'm jumping ahead. That is a question. For those who've, I wonder a bit of context, we're in this sort of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob narrative, these so-called patriarchs of Israel. And at one level, this story functions as a renaming of Jacob. Mm. He will leave being renamed Israel. And we get told he has two wives and two slave girls. We should read slave girls as really concubines. Mm. And there's 11 boys. There might be girl children. They're not important enough to name. But the 12th child, Benjamin, will come along, and these will be the 12 tribes of Israel. So this is at one level functioning as a kind of almost a blessing and a wrestling and a strange call renaming identity story. Mm. But there's so many layers to unpack.
Yeah, and the context of it for me is fascinating, because it's part of this cycle of stories in which Jacob has proven himself to be a not terribly nice character, a trickster, a bit of a fraudster, really.
Yep.
And he's in the process of returning from his father-in-law Laban's lands. In fact, he's on the run from Laban, having already been on the run from his brother Esau. And so... He's caught betwixt and between these two poles, as it were, Laban and Esau. Mm. And, you know, he's at this crossing point.
Yeah. And, yeah, sorry, John.
Well, I think he's brought to the crossing point because he's brought into the what I will call the prevailing ideology of communism, of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
The last book I published before retirement was called Hard Work Never Killed Anybody.
Okay.
And that could be Jacob's sort of swan song, because it actually ends up not so much killing him but wounding him. Mm. So after his sort of betrayal of his brother, he grows up to be a really hard worker.
Yep.
And he goes to all this effort to prove his worth by his hard work. And every time he thinks he's made it, the system betrays him, whether it's his uncle or whoever.
Yep.
So he ends up, in a sense, confronted with this sense of the system's not working for him.
Mm.
And where does he go with that? So he's not prepared to give up his belief in the virtue of hard work. So he absolutely kills it. You know, like he loads up everything for this journey home.
Yep.
And the journey brings him to the turning point, which is a profound turning point for anybody who's been injured by their work. Mm. And the work injury becomes his awareness of a greater power in his life than his own efforts.
Mm.
And his woundedness becomes his salvation, if you like. It becomes the basis of him getting a new name, because in the wounding he realises that God has been at work in all of this to bring him to this point of disillusionment with what he believed would be his salvation, and an awareness that he actually had to find a new starting point in his trust in the promise that had been made to his ancestors. And so the whole shift here, I think, will speak strongly to anybody who listens to this with an injury from their work or from their experience, which has brought them to a new understanding of their dependence on God's grace for who they are and where they might go.
Yeah, and their identity. So often our identity is deeply tied to our work, right?
Profoundly so.
And that can be good. I mean, that might be natural. I don't know what you both think. But he finds blessing in the new identity, I guess. I found this a fascinating way to look at the story, because you've made me realise this, you know, early on part of the setting up of the scene is he sends all his possessions, including his family members, which in a patriarchal society are possessions, across the stream to keep them safe and finds himself alone. And there's something in there about you can have all the possessions in the world and you're still alone to face God in the night. Like,
well, but is he trying to keep them safe, or is at this point, is he still trying to game the system by which he's been wounded?
Mm.
Because that other side of the river is where Esau is, and he's coming from that direction. And Jacob has already sent emissaries across the river to try and slow Esau down, and now he's sent his family across the river.
You think he's trying to kind of almost buy them out, or maybe?
Absolutely. He's still trying to game this system.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But it speaks to the power of if you like, capitalist ideology or any sort of work-related ideology that connects identity to effort, human effort.
Mm.
So it takes, in many cases, a significant, painful event to break the hold of that ideology on the human heart.
Yep.
And that's what I think is happening here for well, that's what I read into it. That's how I listen to it.
Yes, through that lens. It you know, and this is what lenses do, right? They help us see things in the text and explore things we might miss.
And we have a contemporary example of that in the disruption caused by COVID. You know, the media is full of stories of people whose identity was invested in their work and in their understanding that it was their job, their work, that would bring them to a place of, if you like, salvation.
Mm.
But the disruption of COVID that has come along and broken into all our systems and has been profoundly wounding for many people has, at least for some of those people in that process, caused them to re-examine what the basis and the foundation of their identity as a human being is.
Yep.
Yeah, there's been a lot of reflection. And with that, I think one of the tensions that I struggle with in this story, it goes back to where you began, Brendan, with this encounter with the other. Because this encounter with God, yes, there's the new identity. Yes, there's a blessing, although he has to fight for this blessing. Like, he hangs on to God and says, I will not, well, if it's God, says, I won't let you go without blessing me. But then he's also wounded, right? Mm. So the woundedness stays and sits alongside this blessing and this identity. And maybe there's something there, and it's hard to extract ourselves from the capitalist system, from the woundedness of work. Like, you know, I guess there's a question in there about how much does the woundedness remain part of who we are, or does it have to?
It remains part of who we are.
Yep.
So the first person that I employed to provide support for people bereaved by work-related death was a woman whose son was killed at work.
Mm-hmm.
And she spent 18 months as a volunteer worker at our agency. And then we gauged together that she was ready to work. She wanted to work in this space. She's still employed in Uniting, doing this work for over 20 years now, supporting bereaved families. So that's how deep a healed wound is. And I think two members of our congregation who are working in the public service in mental health, both who have had hospitalisations with their own mental health issues. So, again, I see that the pain of their experience is the turning point.
Mm.
And there is also, I think, a really helpful reading of this from Indigenous storytellers. So Father Glenn Lowry at our congregational retreat earlier this year actually told us this story as a restorative justice story, and he told it in relation to the practice of dealing with someone who'd committed a serious crime within an Indigenous community, where they would be speared in the leg.
Yep.
And the point of that was that this was a decision of the community, that this was the appropriate punishment, the appropriate level of pain that needed to be inflicted on that person for the harm and the pain that they'd caused the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn's point was that from that point on, that, say it's a man, that man would know that he has to depend on the community for killing kangaroo meat for him or for his livelihood, that he would always carry the injury as a reminder of his own perpetration of harm. Yep. But because the community has acknowledged that he is sorry mm-hmm. for the harm he's caused, they will gather around him to support him.
Yeah.
And so the wounding in this story may well be the point, I think, that connects with that Indigenous storytelling, that mm-hmm. The response to the pain of the community or of the ancestral spirits is what keeps the wounded person alive, not only alive but refocused on living a productive life.
Mm. And in what I've heard too, aware of their dependence then on
exactly.
others, right? So
yep.
we stop
yep.
because, you know, part of the capitalist system is we all yep. get told if you strive hard enough, right, mm. you succeed, you can create your own mini kingdom, I guess.
Exactly.
And actually one of the things we discovered during COVID, and I don't want to speak as if COVID is over because it is not, but during lockdowns and some of the worst times of that, is how much we actually needed each other.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I mean, the other layer here, of course, is, you know, and this is a more traditional interpretation, is this wrestling in the night. I mean, we know many of us, I'm an insomniac, we wrestle, right, with our demons, whatever they be. In the night, there's something about the symbolism of darkness and the spiritual grappling with identity and blessing and woundedness and who we are.
You've raised a really interesting question, yep. Robin, about whether – I mean, it's a question that I remember from my student days, which Bruce Barber would have asked, and that was, how do you know that you are wrestling with demons?
Mm.
So what's your discernment of the spiritual nature of that wrestling? Mm. And I've been talking with someone who is currently in hospital mental illness, and her greatest fear is of the darkness because for her that is punishment. Mm. And so my conversation with her was about the promise of God to be in every sphere of life, which included the darkness.
Yes.
And where was God in the darkness? And what she'd been taught by the church about sin and evil and darkness, while there's a truth in it, it's not that absolute a truth. It's not, its power is so great that while it might seem to be shutting out God, it doesn't. Mm. And, you know, God's intention is to come through that, to be part of the life-giving energy that's hidden in there.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, maybe the comfort in a story like this is that God is found precisely in the darkness.
Exactly.
And that, yeah, we could, who are we wrestling with in our inner selves? What yep. part of that sometimes self-doubting voice, that anxious voice, what part of that is actually God, or can we
yes.
rethink it as God meeting yep. us in the struggle?
And in that concept of darkness, of mystery, of the stranger coming at night, modernity has its own mystery religion. It's called economics.
You yeah.
know, no one quite understands how it works or even if it works at all, but it has its celebrity high priests and it has its influencers and all that sort of thing. But as some dissenting economists like Thomas Piketty and Thomas Sedlacek and John Quiggin and others have demonstrated, the scale of their influence compared to the actual veracity of their prognostications is out of all proportion. And the problem is that this mystery religion we call economics makes a huge amount of promise. And as John said, it's that thing about work hard enough for long enough, and by dint of sheer hard work and willpower, you will be able to resurrect your life into something other.
Yeah.
You'll be able to liberate yourself from the cycle of wage dependence or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But the reality is that mystery religion leaves in its wake every year tens of thousands of people who are killed, wounded, or otherwise damaged by its outworkings. But in this reading, we have the darkness of God that comes to Jacob in the night and wounds him, but in that wounding reconstitutes his life. And breaks him out of the system that we were talking about earlier, in which he continually tries to game, but which continually backfires on him.
Yeah.
And, you know, unlike the mystery religion of economic ideology, which leads only to appropriation and co-option of human life and leaves behind unhealed wounding, the wounding of God that comes to us in the night is redemptive and restorative.
Mm. Yep. And, well, we need to move on to the gospel reading, but I want to pick up some of those threads there and, you know, bringing in economics as well. We get to Matthew, we've got some redistribution, we've got some all sorts of interesting things going on. So let's pick up that thread.
Sure.
So Matthew 14:13-21, often known as the feeding of the 5,000, I want to say plus, that's just the men, women and children. And the context here that I think is really important, particularly if we think of this in terms of ancient economics, is the story right before this is the story of the beheading of John the Baptist. So Jesus, we pick up the story with Jesus hearing about John's death and he withdraws to kind of reflect and grieve, we assume. But John's beheading happens in the context of a different feast, and this is a feast at Herod's palace where there's dancing and luxurious food. So we also get a contrast of two types of feeding stories that we need to sort of juxtapose here. One where the elite would have been invited and fed very well, that relied on reciprocal relationships and political kind of gain. So those kind of dinner parties you have when you really want to suck up to other people and make sure you're invited to their dinner party versus the kind of feeding story we encounter with Jesus. So what did you notice in this reading? What do you want to pick up in Matthew? I mean, it's very well known, right? So again, we've got to disrupt some of our familiarity perhaps.
Well, I think we have to begin with scarcity. And scarcity is a fundamental of modern economic ideology, because scarcity argues that, or acknowledges that, resources are finite, but that finite nature of resources helps to regulate the market, so that when a resource becomes depleted and rarer, the costs associated with its production and consumption go up. Therefore, its use will come down. Therefore, we're actually preserving a finite resource. But in truth, what scarcity leads to is overproduction and hoarding and vast inequalities. I mean, we are sold daily this lie that there's just not enough food to go around. You know, that food is a scarce resource and that water is a scarce resource. But the truth is, the industrialized West produces enough food and uses enough water to feed the entire world many times over on a daily basis.
And then we waste so much of it as well.
And that's exactly it. We waste so much of it.
Yep.
And that waste is a result of overproduction and over-hoarding that derives from this principle of scarcity, which is at the heart of modern economic theory.
Yep. And I mean, for me, that maps on to what I know of the ancient world, where that scarcity was probably more obvious than it is in at least our modern middle class culture, which is where a lot of us listening will probably be located. You know, one of the things that always strikes me in this story is that the people leave filled, satiated, and that would have been a rare thing if you're of the working class, so to speak, in Jesus' day, enough food on your table, enough calories would have been a daily struggle. Mm. And actually feasting to the point of fullness would have been a rare thing. And, of course, that is true for so many in our world still today.
Absolutely. But it's interesting that the disciples' initial response to the people is the response of economic scarcity.
Yes.
We don't have anything here. Let them go off into the towns and buy stuff.
Yeah.
Irrespective of the fact that they may not have the means to purchase that stuff, and irrespective also of the impact on the people in those towns of a horde of people
all arriving
on them, all at once. It's, you know, like all the relatives turning up at Christmas suddenly, you know.
Yeah.
So the disciples' initial response is entirely in accord with modern economic notions of scarcity. Mm. Let the market sort it out. Let them deal with it.
Yeah, we don't have enough.
That's right. Yep. But Jesus' response is one of compassion that's not just theoretical solidarity with them. It actually demands a response, an action.
Mm. And then Jesus almost co-opts them into that by sending them out, right? They actually have to go carry the food, so they get almost retrained.
Yep. It's a great retraining story. I think that the sort of dynamic that Brendan has described is actually at the beginning of the reading.
Okay.
So the reading says, now when Jesus heard this, he heard about the violent brutality of the other meal. He heard about the death of his cousin.
Yep.
And the political undertones of that whole thing. So why wouldn't you just take a break? You know, like, and so there is in that movement, if you like, a sense of his emptying.
Mm.
He just needs to just sort of take a break to have some space to gather himself. But as soon as he's aware of the crowd coming, he looks at them with compassion, and there's the abundance straight there. So there is this sort of sense, I think, in spiritual direction of the importance of emptying, of being able to let go, or not even let go, but to acknowledge the feelings of sadness, of grief, of...
Yeah, when you've got nothing else to give and you need to withdraw or...
And in honouring the feelings, you're actually being true to yourself. And I must say the Christian community is really bad at that in the Western world because we're so caught up in trying to prove our value with work.
Yes, that and we don't, doing.
That we don't actually understand the rhythm of prayer and the rhythm of a spiritual discipline that validates having a break, taking time out, being attentive to the spirit. So Jesus comes to this sort of incident on top of his game, if you like. I mean, he knows who he is and he knows what he can do. And I'm probably a little bit sort of I'm not too hard on the disciples at this point because I think they're doing what they think is best, which is, as Brendan has said, play the system or follow the rules of the system.
Mm. Yeah, they're being normal in their world, right? Mm-hmm. This isn't a reasonable response.
And so Jesus, in a sense, accepts them in their understanding of what might be helpful. Mm. But he then turns it around. And I think this is a warning about Christians being helpful. You know, we're so caught up in the charity sort of mentality of the late 19th century as a response to capitalism that we haven't really moved beyond what the market demands of us as community service providers. Mm. And we're so caught up now in the privatisation of community services as something that's building the church's property wealth. Oof.
Yeah.
You know? So... I think what happens here is that Jesus sort of understands that they're doing, in a sense, what society would think was a sensible thing, but he wants to open their eyes to what God might be calling them to.
Yeah.
And it is a calling into solidarity. Because once they open their hearts to the possibility that these few loaves and fishes might have something to offer, and they listen to Jesus offer his blessing over the food, and then they start distributing it, and by golly, then they start picking up the leftovers.
Yeah.
There's a whole experience there of, as you said, being retrained in what it means to be helping. And if your helping is not producing solidarity, if it's making me feel good and the other person remains in their hunger.
Yes, yes.
That's fitting into an economic system that is fundamentally unjust. So the justice in this is actually the acceptance of people, I think, where they are in their struggles with making ends meet.
Yep.
But finding a way to come alongside them that opens their eyes to a new possibility. And I'm hoping that you'll have a bit more to say about that last verse, Robin, than I can come to terms with. But, I mean, in my Jerusalem Bible, it says something like, and those who ate were about 5,000 men, and the Jerusalem Bible says, not counting the women and children. And
why count them?
Well, the word count is a trigger for me at the moment because Indigenous Australians are saying we were counted in 1966. Now we're asking for a voice. So I'm trying to work out what's this.
What does it mean to be counted?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Or not counted. Not counted in this case. Yeah.
But it does seem to me that the way Matthew's framed this is inclusive but diminutive.
Yeah. I think we get that in the New Testament in that we get sometimes obvious disruptions, and then of the system, and one of the systems operative here is patriarchy, and then sometimes we get that just reflected. So the fact that you would count the men but not really bother counting the women and children because they belong to the men, I think, is maybe just reflecting a cultural norm. But the fact that they get mentioned at all suggests that this is a much larger crowd. So we've also got something, like you say, we've got hints of inclusion and actually such vast numbers. I mean, 5,000 is,
sure,
let's be honest, probably an exaggeration. That'd be a huge amount of people given what we know of the population of villages around this part of the world at the time. So we've got eschatological overtones going on here with feasting or the, you know, all these Hebrew Bible narratives about, you know, at the end you'll be filled, God feeds you, this feasting, and I think that's part of the abundance going on.
Yeah, but there's a articulation of abundance that leads off John's point earlier about this kind of diminutive inclusion. The abundance that we see here is not the wasteful abundance of overproduction and hoarding that we see today. I mean, there was a report released recently that showed that Western industrialized nations have used up so much groundwater in the last century, the actual Earth's axis has tilted.
Yep.
So our wastefulness and our hoarding is impacting the very planet on which we live, and it's not just through climate change, folks.
It's through direct action of hoarding and greed. Yep.
But in this passage, there is an articulation of abundance that leaves abundance in reserve for those who are not yet fed.
Yeah. Yes.
So unlike contemporary notions of abundance, which are about my possession and, you know, if the third world or even if the homeless bloke at the local supermarket gets some crumbs off the table, well and good, this is a story of abundance almost as extraordinary as the abundance that has been provided, kept in reserve for those who are not yet fed.
Yes, for those who have not yet come but will. That's right. Yep, I like that. We've got just a couple of minutes left, so I'd love your last thoughts. I think these are actually – we didn't plan this I didn't plan this precisely, but this has been a really good week to have you both here from – working the lectionary, because I think Both readings have invited us to think, maybe you think every Bible reading does, but to think about economics and work and exactly what systems are operative here. Is there anything else you want to sort of say as we wind up that we haven't touched on?
I think one of the things that I find is the lectionary is both a gift and a trap. So yep. As a younger preacher, I tended to just go for the reading and focus it. But I think it's been important for both of the readings today to look at what was happening before we got to the reading.
Yep.
So that we understand what's happening. And you used a word in relation to the genesis of kingdoms. This is an issue about sort of kingdoms.
Yep.
And I think that is applies equally. We're looking at two kingdoms here.
Yeah, we are.
You know, the kingdom of not just Herod, but the whole Roman Empire and all of that might stand for, and the kingdom of God and what that might mean. But it means something about that sort of feasting and
yeah. fullness.
So I'm struck, the more I'm sort of working with Brendan on that, is how often the Bible just brings us back to these sort of two kingdom
yep.
themes. I think that it really is calling on the church to recover our confidence in speaking about the kingdom of sin, of evil, and the powers that underlie that and the harm that they do, and the kingdom of God and the gift of Christ's death and resurrection and
yeah.
and the grace that's available to followers of the way of Jesus to endure this system and perhaps to transform parts of it, but certainly not to be bowed down by it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think if I was going to preach on the Matthew, I'd be inclined to read the Herod story first and look yes. at this as these are two types of feasts in two types of kingdoms, yeah. One that leads to death, leads to reward for a few and death for those who oppose it, and that reflects lots about our society right now. Mm. And then the Jesus kingdom that, as you say, has abundance left over for those who will yet come. I was going to say something else, but it's left my head. Brendan,
look, I think this exercise that John and I are trying to do through our podcast of thinking about work and economy through the lens of the lectionary is also about the need for Christians and the church to recall that economy is a theological term.
Yeah,
it didn't become a technocratic term until about the 17th, 18th century. It's a theological term that describes relationship and the basis upon which relationships operate and are constructed. And when we talk about things like scarcity and abundance and the narratives that run through the whole patriarch's cycle in the Hebrew scriptures, we are being called to reflect on the fact that if we as Christians have lost the theological meaning of economy, it is because we have become co-opted by modern economic ideologies. And we need to break out of that co-option if we are to speak into the yeah. woundedness of the world and to speak of a way of life that is about fruitfulness, not productivity.
Yes. And not, I see the church all the time, we are operating out of these models of scarcity at every level.
Yes.
And it does not lead to helpful and flourishing behaviour. It actually leads us as the church to do our own hoarding, right?
That's right.
So there's all sorts of ways this plays out.
That's right. And to be captive to the ideology of achievement.
Yes.
And the despair that results when we don't meet the demands of that idol.
That's a powerful note to end on. Thank you. You might be listening to this on Working the Lectionary, but if you're not, you've been listening to John Bottomley and Brendan Byrne from Working the Lectionary, and we'll put a link in our podcast notes. But thanks both for being here. It's been a lovely conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Wonderful.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this special crossover episode of Working the Lectionary, and John and I would like to thank Robin for inviting us to join her on the By the Well podcast. And if you'd like to check out By the Well, there's a link in the episode notes. If you'd like to leave any comments, suggestions, or feedback, please go to the podcast website at www.workingthelectionary.podbean.com. Working the Lectionary is available on Podbean, the hosting service for this podcast, but it is now also available through Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. In the meantime, John and I look forward to your company for the next episode of Working the Lectionary. Goodbye for now.
This has been Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary.